Before we dive into today's discussion, we have a special resource just for you, a free ebook called Does It Make Sense to Believe in God? In today's world where faith is often labelled as outdated or irrational, this ebook takes a fresh look at the evidence for God. It features reflections from years of engaging with some of the world's leading atheists, like Richard Dawkins, and reveals why, after hearing every conceivable argument, our confidence in God's existence is stronger than ever. Download Does It Make Sense to Believe in God today for free at premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. Now, let's get started with today's show.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined by my dad, John Wyatt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And today we are looking at genes, eugenics, embryo testing, classic MOLAD fodder. But it all was all kicked off by an interesting news story you actually found from the US about a company called 23andMe. Can you just quickly explain to people who haven't come across it, what exactly is 23andMe? What services does it offer?
Yeah, 23andMe has been around for some time as a commercial company, which has been direct to consumer. In other words, just advertising on the internet. And you've probably seen billboards with adverts saying, you know, we can collect your saliva and you can learn all about yourself. And particularly, you can learn all about your heritage. You can learn who you're related to and what's not to like. Learn more about yourself. And of course, we're all very ethical and we will never use your data in ways that you wouldn't approve of.
Yeah. And so it's not the only company that offers a service. I mean, I'm sure people listening have done this. It's become quite a common thing to kind of give a family member for Christmas kind of thing. You give them a little DNA testing kit. You normally spit into a test tube and post it off back to the company. And they run a whole series of tests on your DNA. And then will in due course, send you an email telling you that you are 5% Swedish or whatever it is. Someone was telling me recently they found out they were 1.6% Sri Lankan heritage, which was slightly surprising to them. And so it's a kind of, on one level, it's a kind of harmless, fun parlor game, understand a bit more about your heritage. But what is interesting now is a news story, which we'll link to in the notes, from The Atlantic, which says that 23andMe is teetering on the brink of kind of bankruptcy and collapse. And one way that co-founder of the company is going to try and save it is considering selling the DNA they have stored of 23andMe's 15 million customers. And so suddenly all the people who have spat in test tubes over many years and sent them off to find out, what they are suddenly now being faced with is the idea that their DNA is not going to be sitting on a server belonging to 23andMe, or very possibly, but it will sold to someone else.
Yeah, and this is American commercial practice, isn't it? That a company that has raised money that was intended to make a big profit, but then is having financial difficulties. There are other companies snapping around who say, you know, how much are we prepared to pay for this? Could this be beneficial for us? Because it'd help our bottom line. And apparently in the small print, which people have ticked, but, you know, as so often, no doubt people haven't read all the details about what they agreed to. Apparently in the small print, it says that all the information that is collected by 23andMe could be sold to another commercial partner.
Hmm. And 23andMe's kind of dream, it's kind of two companies really, is it has the kind of direct-to-consumer testing for, you know, telling you what color your eyes are if you haven't quite realized yet, and where your heritage is, and, you know, people finding sometimes can with similar companies can find long lost relatives who have also uploaded their DNA, who might be a cousin or something like that across any other part of the world. But they also had a kind of in-house drug development team, so kind of a pharmaceutical side, where they were trying to use this huge treasure trove of DNA data they'd collected to try and develop drugs that they would then sell into the healthcare industry. And it's that, apparently, which has been shut down. So it's a kind of a bait and switch. You could argue that they're providing people this kind of fun parlor game, and in return, people don't just pay the kind of $20-$30, whatever it costs to get one of these kits, but they were also effectively paying by giving 23andMe and its future companies and spin-offs and whoever it's sold to access to their unique genomic data for doing all kinds of things. I mean, it's not just about healthcare. There's also law enforcement. You know, there's police agencies are often very keen to get hold of this kind of data because they have shown that it can actually use it to solve crimes. That a most famous one was a sometimes called the Golden State Killer, a horrendous serial killer who wasn't caught for about 30 or 40 years until police decided to upload some DNA that they thought was the killer. He didn't appear in any of their databases. He'd never been arrested before. They uploaded the DNA to one of these big style kind of like ancestry tracing heritage websites and managed to find out who the person was, not because he had spat into a test tube, but because some of his extended family members had, and they could trace the DNA through that. So there's huge concerns, I guess, around privacy, around, you know, can someone own the DNA that is unique to you?
Yeah, and this immediately points out one of the incredibly important factors about DNA information, which isn't true for something like, you know, your fingerprint, or the kind of privacy data we often use in terms of smartphones and in terms of getting access, where it looks at your face and so on. Because if someone gets hold of my DNA, that has implications not only for me, but it also has implications for you, Tim, because we're related.
We've got 99.99999% the same DNA, I suspect.
Well, no, that's not right. Like, we've got 50%, because it's also 50% of your DNA comes from your dear mother.
Fair point.
But
I thought I shared most of my DNA with a tree and a fruit fly or something like
that's
that.
That's also true. That's also true. But anyway, leaving out those other relatives, so this is a very important point. If I go for a screening test to see whether, for instance, I might be carrying a gene for cancer, and that has positive, that immediately has implications for you and for the rest of the people who are related to me.
Are they obliged to, if you find out that you had some genetic condition, is the NHS here in the UK obliged to get in touch with me and tell me I also am carrying the same gene?
Well, this is where we get into really murky ethics. And it is for this reason that you can't get a genetic test on the DNA, on the NHS. You can't get your genome fully analysed through the NHS without undergoing some form of genetic counselling, that you, in theory at least, should sit down with an expert who discusses with you the possible implications, not only for you but for your family, of discovering particular variants and so on. And have you thought it all through? And what would you wish to disclose if it turns out that you were carrying a particular gene variant? Would you want your children to know? So you can't be forced. Unless the only situation you could be forced is if I didn't tell you this, there was a high risk that you might die. And if I did tell you, I could protect your life because you could take steps, whatever it was. In those situations, then ethically, there might be a reason for a doctor to transgress the normal duty of confidentiality. But normally when I get any kind of test with the NHS, that's entirely confidential to me as a competent adult. But the whole point is that when you do this through a commercial website, you don't get any counselling at all. You just tick a few boxes. Have you read and understood? Yes. And then you hand over your information. And I think that is the huge problem with consumer testing. And it is interesting, isn't it, that apparently part of the reason why 23andMe is not doing very well is that the public's appetite for doing this is going down. And I suspect partly it's because these various Googlers are now becoming apparent.
And is it also actually that some of the promise of genetic testing has turned out to be a bit more complicated? You know, I remember maybe kind of 10, 15 years ago when this kind of technology was really taking off, there was lots of very excitable coverage and ideas that, you know, genetics would completely transform medicine and everyone would have these personalized drugs that worked like magic and it would all be bish bash bosh, would be solve all that stuff. And actually it's turning out to be a lot more complicated and difficult, and that 23andMe may have 15 million genomes to play around with in its database, but it's actually not proven easy or straightforward to turn that into commercially viable, useful therapies.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, there are undoubtedly a collection of so-called single gene disorders where there's one particular gene which has a high chance of being associated with a problem. I think quite a lot of people have probably heard about the BRCA gene, yes, the BRCA gene, which
breast cancer, is it?
It's a whole range of cancers, in fact. And if you have two copies of that gene, you have a really quite a high risk of having various forms of cancer, but that's unusual. Most of the health information you get from the genome is much less has had direct implications. And so-called precision medicine, which is the idea of trying to target your medical interventions based on your unique genetic characteristics, it is coming. It's particularly making a big impact within cancer, where it's turning out that a significant number of cancers are related to genetic factors, and where you can target anti-cancer treatments depending on the genetics of the cancer. It's very complex, and in many areas of medicine, it still hasn't come. The promise is there, but it still hasn't become a reality.
And are there any kind of protections built into law or into regulation about our DNA? Or is it, once I've handed my spit over to 23andMe, it's gone for good and that private company can do with it what they like?
Well, this is the difference between the NHS and major health providers across the world, who tend to have very careful controls over DNA information and what's used and making it available and so on, versus the wild west of the commercial world, you know. And the interesting thing about so much of things that are going on the internet is that it's basically, these are commercial companies ruled by, you know, a board of directors and have with investors and so on. And in the end, it's shareholder value which directs the decisions. These are not set up as companies whose first aim is to protect the rights and concerns of the people who use their services.
There is a law in the United States from 2008 called the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, which does say that it's not allowed for employers and health insurers, for instance, to look at your genetic data and then discriminate against you. But apparently, according to the Atlantic article, which we've linked to, there are gaps in it. There are loopholes that allow certain kinds of insurance companies, if you're offering life insurance, disability insurance, which means that if they can, for example, find out that you have genetically carry the gene that is associated with developing kind of heart disease in the future, they might whack up your life insurance premium to compensate themselves, even if you actually, as many people will, carry that gene your whole life and never actually go on to develop any heart disease. So there are some attempts, but it sounds like that, at least in the US, they're not super robust.
Yeah, the whole issue about insurance is fascinating. Years ago, I was on the research ethics committee at my university, and I remember discussing a particular research proposal which had implications for insurance companies. And what emerged in the sort of discussion is that there are basically two models of insurance. There's one model of insurance where a whole group of people just get together and spread their risks. So, you know, you get 1,000 people and they say, let's all pool our, you know, put so much in the kitty. And then if anybody has a real problem, that'll bail us out. But we just basically spread our risks. But there's another model of insurance, which is all about predicting risk. and saying, you know, are you a high risk or a low risk person? If you're a high risk person, we're not interested in you. If you're a low risk person, we will give you substantial insurance. Hmm. So, and so the insurance industry is all based on predicting, predicting risk. And the argument goes, whereas you see the NHS, the cover you get from the NHS is irrespective of your, it's a pooling process. Yeah, the community is pooling its resources. The fact that you're a terrible prospect doesn't mean, oh, I'm sorry, we can't afford you. Hmm. So it is interesting, isn't it? Because insurance companies already, they ask you, you know, did anybody die in your family? You know, are there any diseases? You know, because all this will help us. You know, have you a history of X, Y, Z?
Yeah.
You know, and you can see how they already do that. In effect, they're already looking at genetic information indirectly. So the argument goes, well, why can't we get hold of your DNA and look at it directly?
Go right to the source. And this was, I recall, part, you know, if you remember the very fevered political debate in the US around Obamacare, one of the big provisions in Obamacare was to stop in health insurers from discriminating on kind of pre-existing conditions. You know, where there was a practice, as I understand it, of a lot of health insurers would, if they found out that you had some kind of long-term chronic condition, they would just refuse to offer you insurance, even though these are the people obviously who need insurance the most, because it was just too expensive. But they wanted to find, to sign up like young, fit, healthy people who would pay their premiums and never actually go to hospital. And that's obviously, as you say, a core part of how insurance is supposed to work, is that you pool risk so that 99 healthy people's premiums can pay for the very expensive care of the 1 in 100 people when they actually need to go to hospital. But it wasn't really, the market wasn't really working because the insurers were just endlessly homing in on the kind of cash cow healthy patients and refusing to cover the more needy ones.
So I think in terms of commercial insurance, this is an insoluble problem for when it comes back to genetics, because I think commercial, whatever rules you try to put fence around it, commercial insurance companies will always be wanting to find what the risk is. And certainly with the genomic data, you can imagine there will be a whole group of people of genetics cripples, you know, lepers, the new lepers, who will basically be uninsurable. I'm sorry, we've looked at your DNA and you must be joking. Yeah. Good luck. Yeah. Which is where you do need this kind of safety blanket, which is available irrespective of, you know, where the community says, we will look after you, whatever.
And that's a kind of core, and we've mentioned it many times before, of the kind of sci-fi film Gattaca, which is a kind of set in a near future world in which everyone is genetically modified and screened to be immaculate and perfect. And there are a small kind of underclass of genetic lepers who do not have the kind of immaculate chromosomes of their peers. And they are kind of ruthlessly discriminated against and kind of squeezed out of public life and prohibited from most major jobs. And, you know, it's a little finger prick test everywhere you go, looks at your blood, immediately checks you are who you say you are, but also looks at what you're, how healthy you are. And as you say, it's a very believable world. And in the same sense, once your genome is out there, whether it's in the database of 23andMe or it's on a police law enforcement agency's database, you can't change your genome. You know, it's like a fingerprint, you're born with it. But even more so, you cannot prevent yourself from leaving behind this kind of genetic trail, this fumes everywhere you go. You know, you could, if you, to stop you leaving your fingerprints everywhere, you just wear gloves. But your genome is encoded into every skin cell that flakes off and falls on the floor, and every hair that drops off, even droplets of your own breath and saliva that you leave behind on surfaces. Everywhere you go, you are leaving a trail of your genetic detritus. And once your genome is being captured by someone, you are forever identifiable. Privacy is dead.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. And this is a fascinating thing about technology, isn't it? Because there are similar things happening on the internet. You know, the idea that you could be a private individual is becoming less
increasingly
and less realistically. Yeah, I mean, this is something about, as technology advances, it creates this surveillance possibility, incredible invasive surveillance, and this is the reality. It's very hard to see how you put the genie back.
Yeah.
into the pot. Should we just go on and talk about Biobank?
Yeah, Biobank. So Biobank is a bit like 23andMe, but done from a completely different angle, in that it's not a private direct-to-consumer company, but it is a huge database of genetic information that was donated by volunteers, and it's run out here in the UK, isn't it?
Yeah, so it's a world-leading resource and phenomenon, and again, very visionary. Back in 2006, a group of leading genetic scientists, of course, the UK has ever since, you know, Watson and Crick in Cambridge were the original, you know, discoverers of DNA, and the UK has been one of the leading centres for genetic science ever since. And back in 2006, the UK Biobank was set up, combining leading genetic scientists with researchers and supported by basically central funding, supported
UK and taxpayers, effectively.
Well, and also the Wellcome Trust, Medical Research Council, you know, all the big names, I think, in medical research funding here in the UK have supported this. And basically, since 2006, they've collected not just genomes, but everything else on 500,000 people, all adults between 40 and 69. And so what they've done with their agreement, in fact, I was approached to be one of these, was would I allow access to all my health data, and would I provide a genome, a source of my genome? And the idea then is that this massive data bank of 500,000 detailed genomes, plus everything that ever happened to those people, continuing on, they continue to record. So if I was to develop a disease in the future, this could be then added into the database. So it is, and in that sense, it's unique. There isn't anything else quite like it in the world, that level of a database, which is now open for research. That's what it's for. Both research by universities, researchers, and so on, but also by commercial companies who have an interest. And they have an ethics committee, and they decide how this data is to be used, and they ensure that it is only released to bona fide researchers.
And this leads us on to the next story, which is in The Guardian, and we also will link to it in the show notes, which is about how a US startup company called Heliospect Genomics has somehow gained access to data, genetic data from the UK Biobank, and has used that, it claims, to build tools which mean that you can screen your embryos for IQ, effectively try and ensure that you have cleverer children.
Yeah, so again, this is an idea that's been around for decades, ever since the development of the first IVF, reproductive technology, over 50 years ago. And the idea is that you can create a large number of embryos in a test tube. So you quote, harvest human eggs, you fertilize them with sperm, and then you have a large number of embryos, and then effectively you test the DNA of each of the embryos, and then you decide to select one or more embryos for reimplantation in the womb. So this is so-called pre-implantation genetic diagnosis.
And we've covered this in previous episodes. We'll link to it in the show notes, all about kind of screening and some of the ethical concerns. But yeah, you were saying.
So this is heavily regulated in the UK. The UK, again, is almost unique with the level of regulation of this kind of technology, fertility, reproductive technology. And the HFEA are absolutely clear that you can only use this kind of screening test in order to identify embryos at a high risk of a serious illness. And so it is used to identify embryos that would go on to get serious illness, particularly where there's a family history. If a previous child died of a horrible rare genetic problem, and the couple say, you know, we desperately want to have another child, but we really can't face the possibility of another child with a similar problem. Then the technology says, okay, we'll create a series of embryos, we'll test each one for this genetic abnormality, and we'll ensure that we only put embryos back that don't carry the same genetic problem. And so this is pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, and it is being carried out in the UK and elsewhere across the world in small but significant numbers.
However, Helioscect, this is a US company, which is still what it calls in stealth mode, so it's not really kind of fully gone live, but some undercover investigation by a research group, campaign group called Hope Not Hate, which kind of targets what it sees as kind of extremist groups, interestingly, decided this company is worth their scrutiny. And so they have undercover video footage showing Helioscect marketing its services at up to $50,000. But they tell future clients that they can test over 100 embryos and can therefore select ones based on genetic predictions of intelligence, which could produce a gain of up to 6 IQ points in your actual future children. And this has apparently already happened for a kind of a dozen couples while the company is kind of still like researching and testing and building out its offer.
But it's not just IQ. So the idea is that you could look for other desirable things like sex, if you want a boy or a girl, height, you want someone tall, risk of obesity and risk of mental illness. And it claims, the company claims, that its prediction tools were built using data provided by UK Biobank. And exactly how they got hold of that data is not clear, but I guess, again, it was another company which approached UK Biobank for some research purposes.
And so there's a couple of things going on here, really. So you have the question of, you know, do we want this? Is this a good thing to select for to select our children based on their traits? I mean, Michael Christensen, who's the CEO of Helioscect, said in a video call last year, everyone can have all the children they want, and they can have children that are basically disease-free, smart, healthy. It's going to be great. So that's the kind of pro side. But there's also the second issue of, is it fair or right that the genetic data donated by UK volunteers for free to UK Biobank, and they were told this genetic data you're giving, plus all the follow-up surveys about what happens to them as a result, is going to be used for, you know, research into producing new treatments for horrible diseases. And actually, it's been used by a slightly shady US startup making an absolute killing by telling prospective parents it can select their most intelligent embryos. Is that fair and just and ethical to the original biobank volunteers?
Well, I've no doubt that it will be seen as a very embarrassing story for UK Biobank, and there will be lots of investigations. How did this happen? You know, what controls do we have? Because, you know, these kind of organizations depend so much on trust and on a belief that, you know, data is safe and all the rest. And, you know, that extent, there have been so many leaks, haven't there, from banks and from organizations and from the health service and so on. And this is probably just another example of leaked information, which has got out and which is very difficult to prevent. I do think the ethics of it are very, very interesting, because of course if choice and autonomy is your guiding principle, the most important thing is that we give people choice. We've accepted that as a foundational principle of medical ethics. There are a number of secular ethicists who would say the principle of autonomy is the principle. Everything else is secondary to the principle of personal autonomy. And then it's quite hard to see what's wrong with it, isn't it? I've heard it said quite neatly, you know, either these genetic characteristics are morally important or they're not. If they're not morally important, why on earth are we worried about it? If they are morally important, why should we stop parents from making morally important decisions? So in other words, you know,
Heads I win, tails you lose.
Exactly right.
And I guess there's a couple of things here. I mean, first, I think it's worth just injecting a note of caution that a lot of scientists working in this field, while they agree that to a large extent intelligence is genetically kind of heritable, it is very, very difficult to disentangle what genes are causing what and what combination of genes might produce what level of intelligence in the future. And it seems pretty clear to me that Heliospect is massively overreaching the actual current state of the science to market itself to prospective parents, saying, if you use our services and use our screening, we can tell you, we can boost your child's IQ. Like, that's not actually a claim that's really justifiable at this stage in the science, is it?
No, I think that's right. And if, of course, you will, if you read very carefully what they say, they will say, we will increase the chances that your child has a high IQ. But are we going to know whether it works or not? Well, it's going to take 20 years and then massive research study before we ever know. So, but in the meantime, you know, just feel the quality, you know, how do you...
And obviously intelligence and is not just a question of what genes you have, but a question of quality of your schooling and your parenting and your environment and any other number of factors. And so they have a get out clause, you know, well, we gave this child the best possible genes, but, you know, the reason they're not a brilliant Nobel Prize winning scientist is because you stuffed up the parenting side after they were born. Nothing to do with us, girl.
Yeah, I'm afraid that's true for you, Tim, really. When I think of the potential that you carried.
Wasted. Tragic.
but
separate from the question about whether any of this is actually real is also that actually what Heliospect want to do is go much further. So the researchers in this Guardian piece, they found that Christensen, the CEO, told them that he envisaged in the future lab-grown eggs would allow couples to create embryos on an industrial scale of 1,000 or even 1,000,000 from which you could hand-pick a truly elite selection. And it might go beyond simply choosing things like height or sex or intelligence to including personality types, avoiding narcissism or psychopathic traits or propensity for depression or picking towards things like creativity or beauty. He said beauty is something lots of people actually ask about. So people want, just as much as they want clever children, they also want good looking children.
We're excited to announce the launch of a brand new podcast from Premier Insight called The Bible Explored with Rico Tice, featuring Rico Tice, a renowned British preacher and apologist. The Bible Explored with Rico Tice offers practical guidance for living out the eternal truth of God's word in everyday life. It will inspire and equip you to boldly share the gospel, even in life's toughest situations. To continue creating content and resources like this, we rely on the generosity of listeners like you. Your support is vital to keep Premier Insight strong and ensure programs like The Bible Explored with Rico Tice can reach more people to equip a generation of Christians to live out their faith with clarity, conviction, and confidence. Simply go to premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. That's premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. Thank you for your support.
Listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
So it's fascinating, isn't it, that eugenics, this basic idea of improving the lot of humanity, has been around, you know, for hundreds of years. You know, elite males have always wanted to sire lots of children. You know, even in ancient cultures, haven't they? You know, wasn't it said that Genghis Khan had
10,000 children, something insane? Yeah, there's like a meaningful number of Europeans have Mongolian DNA, which is a legacy of the kind of Genghis Khan horde sweeping through in the 1300s or whenever it was, and, you know, raping and pillaging on an industrial scale and leaving behind traces of their DNA to this day in kind of Western European communities.
But the idea of making better children and selecting the very best out of the bunch is a very ancient heritage, but it's sort of taken on it's interesting how the ideas were really around in the 19th century. I think we've talked again about this before, but the Galton was one of the pioneers of all this, one of the founders of genetics, and he created a laboratory at my own university, University College London, and that was the Laboratory of Genetics. But it was actually called Eugenics, the Laboratory of Eugenics, and it's only changed its name relatively recently. So and the idea of we breed better cattle.
Yeah.
We've been very successful at breeding trees and
fruit and vegetable, else. Yeah. Or everything we eat has been selectively bred, hasn't it?
So why on earth
produce better fruit or be sweeter or not have seeds or whatever?
So why on earth are we not selectively breeding humans? What a ridiculous sort of failure of imagination and potential.
And this really kicked off, didn't it, in the earlier 20th century, I think from the kind of 1920s and 30s onwards. So before the discovery of DNA, but there was this idea that we should be, that states had a responsibility to kind of improve the stock, using that kind of animal husbandry metaphor of their citizenry. And so you saw some countries experimenting with what we would see as kind of grotesque authoritarian experiments, but forcible sterilization of women who were deemed to be undesirable, lower, often, you know, ethnic minorities, poor women deemed to be from a lower class. You know, we don't want, or women who've already had children who are, you know, delinquent, and we don't want them to breed anymore. And this idea that if we can sterilize enough of the kind of bad people, then gradually only good people will have children and the kind of overall genetic stock and health of the citizenry will improve. And these laws terrifyingly carried on in some states in the US and in some countries like Sweden as late as the 60s and 70s. There were still sterilizations going on in a misguided attempt to try and improve the genetic quality.
Yeah, it's absolutely right that certainly in the early decades of the 20th century, these ideas were almost accepted common sense, of course. You know, every right-thinking person.
Yeah, like good liberals were in favour of
absolutely.
This.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It was compassionate.
This was and just common sense. And it was really, of course, the Third Reich and the and the horrific, as it became apparent, I think, in the post-war years, quite how horrific the Third Reich had become with their racial theories and racial cleansing and so on, that the whole field of eugenics became massively tainted. And for a while, it was just unthinkable. You just couldn't go there.
Yeah.
But it is interesting how it is being very much refashioned and rehabilitated as a concept.
And this is sometimes called liberal eugenics. And so there's a connection here with Heliospect, the startup, because among their senior staff is an academic called Jonathan Anomaly, which is a fascinating name, who has previously was a kind of Oxford University academic who defended or kind of proposed what he described as liberal eugenics. And he now works full time for Heliospect. And the core idea here is, rather than the kind of crude authoritarian eugenics of the kind of early 20th century, when, you know, all we could do was stop undesirable people from producing children, the idea of proponents of liberal eugenics say, well, what we can do now is we have the concept of DNA and genes. We understand how things are passed down. And so we can use modern technology to stop undesirable genetic traits from being passed down. But it's liberal, not authoritarian, because it's all done on consent. It all means that parents are free to choose their children, to choose not to pass on certain traits and to actively select for other traits. And on the surface of it, if your framework is simply about autonomy and choice and liberalism, how do you object to that idea?
Well, it is a very fundamental question about what it means to be human, because I think if you were to adopt a kind of physicalist, materialist understanding of what it means to be human, then it's very hard to see what's wrong with it. If basically we are biological mechanisms, and sometimes sadly our biological mechanisms are faulty, And at other times, there are some biological mechanisms which seem to be very superior. What on earth could possibly be wrong with wanting to ensure that we have more superior mechanisms and that we try to get rid of the inferior mechanisms? I mean, this is just madness, really, to think that one shouldn't be doing that, that there was something precious about maintaining inferior mechanisms. And yet, it's interesting, isn't it? Because at a strictly rationalistic, logical level, you can see that. And yet, I think every parent would have deep intuitions that there's something wrong about that. And also, what does this say about society? So it goes back to this very fundamental question of what it means to be human and what it means to be part of a human community.
Yeah. And how we view our children. Are they gift? Are they commodity? You know, and people, us kind of moderns, look back at, you know, read stories of cultures like ancient Sparta, where, you know, the community would look at children as they were born and then would deliberately discard and kill via exposure those that were deemed to be kind of runts of the litter that had disabilities or weren't strong enough and big enough, because in Sparta, every child, every boy had to kind of, you know, be big enough to carry a spear and fight for the country. And we kind of recoil from that as barbaric and everything else. But at the same time, I think we need to think carefully, because we might, if we're saying, and as the UK regulations say, it's perfectly decent and proper, in fact, an act of a moral good to check if your the DNA of your embryo suggests it's going to develop a horrible disease. And almost no British people would object to that. Well, the liberal eugenicists say, well, why can't we extend that further to say, I want to check if my child is going to develop obesity and also unpleasant condition that is socially harmful? What's the principled reason why we're fine doing some forms of selection and not others? Is there actually a clear, bright dividing line between different kinds of embryo and genetic selection?
Well, no, and I think it does make you go back and look at that prenatal screening and to ask, does this really fit with our understanding of what it means to be human? So it's something that we've often mentioned before, I think, in podcasts, but that is this very interesting doublethink between, for instance, Down syndrome, that most people would say, of course, a child or an adult with Down syndrome should be protected. They should be treated exactly the same as anyone else. They shouldn't be discriminated against. And at the same time, they would say, but if Down syndrome is detected in an unborn baby, of course, parents should have the right to have an abortion. And really, those two things don't really compute, because there's a fundamental logical problem there. And I think the same applies really to pre-implantation genetic screening, that it's... it creates questions about, is this really appropriate? And it's a very interesting test case. Is do you think it's appropriate for people to screen out children according to their genetic sex? I mean, basically, why don't we select for boys? Because boys, you know, have advantages compared with women in our current society. If parents want to make sure they're having a boy, why shouldn't they use the technology? And yet, deep down, we think that can't be right. That's not appropriate in a community.
Underlines why the principle of consent alone is not sufficient as a way of organizing our kind of moral decisions around these questions, contrary to what the liberal eugenicists would have you argue. You know, so for example, there are societies where effective, you know, eugenics around sex happens. You know, in countries like India, the rates are astonishing. You know, for something like, for every 1,000 boys that are born, something like only 900 girls are born in India. When obviously in nature, it's almost exactly 50-50. And the reason for that is, unfortunately, in some communities, in some cultures, when women find out they are carrying a girl, they are pressured or choose to abort that child and start again and keep trying till you have a boy. And you know, this is kind of condemned and illegal, but it is understandable in a culture where it is incredibly expensive to have a girl because you have to do a bride price and they're not able to earn as much money to support the family. Like, it is a practical, rational, economic choice for certain poor Indian parents to decide to have a boy. And yet we all agree if we let everyone give free choice about what sex their children are, it's going to have deeply harmful social, society-wide ramifications. So we have to restrict people's autonomy and consent.
Yeah, and so from a philosophical point of view, you need a much richer and deeper framework in order to decide what is right and what is wrong. And in particular, you need a kind of framework about what is the good. What is the meaning of good for a society? What is the meaning of good for a community? What is the meaning of good for an individual human life?
What is a good child? What does a good family look like?
Exactly. And unless you have some kind of vision of the good life and of what it means to fulfill your potential as a human being, you can't make moral decisions. Choice itself is just too thin and too limited. Autonomy by itself is not enough. And the problem in our modern world is that we don't agree on what is a good life and what does a good community look like. We have these fundamental disagreements. And yet, politically, ultimately, democratically, we have to agree together that there are certain things we will allow genetic screening to do, and there are certain things we will not allow genetic screening. And that is because we have a vision of what a good society, what a good community should be like.
And do you think that it is basically all or nothing? That actually the current attempt we have in here in the UK, at least, to say there is good screening and there is bad screening is fundamentally philosophically incoherent. And you either have to prohibit all screening and say children are received and accepted and as a gift as they are, we won't meddle with them, we won't select them. Or you say we're going to screen and we're going to screen for absolutely everything. We can't draw distinctions between health conditions and intelligence.
Well, again, I think you need to make a distinction between what I personally feel is best and what we as a democratic, pluralistic society can pass laws for. And I personally, we didn't undergo any genetic screening, including testing for Down syndrome. And we felt that this was not appropriate for something that we wanted to when we were having children. Do I think there should be a law prohibiting that? No, I don't. In this pluralistic society, there are many other people who would have a different conclusion. And I feel that probably the law as it is at the moment is a best kind of compromise. The law is a very messy business, but I think having some guidelines, having some limits. So I would support, as far as the regulation of the technology, I think the UK approach is the best of a bad job. It has lots of weaknesses, but it's certainly better than the kind of free-for-all, which I think is what we're seeing in many countries, including in the USA.
Briefly then, what is a Christian vision for kind of good parenting, the goods that children we should be aspiring for? If we instinctively agree that it's not right for parents to try and control whether their children are intelligent or not, what is our own like positive vision for what good parenting, good child rearing looks like?
Well, one of the most helpful frameworks I came across, which is by no means original, is that you can understand parenthood under two main processes. The first is an affirming process, that what parents do is they affirm the uniqueness of their children. They accept them as they are. They rejoice in them with all their funny peculiarities, and they accept them and love them unconditionally. So there's an affirming aspect of parenthood, and yet at the same time there's a transforming aspect of parenthood, and that is that we just don't want to leave our children as we found them. We want to help them to fulfill their potential. We want to mold them. We want to encourage them to grow and learn and to become full members of the community, to fulfill their potential, and so on. And this is what education is all about, both informal education in the home and formal education outside. And so there are these two aspects, the affirming and the transforming, and that good parenting holds the balance between those two. It somehow, it recognizes both. The problem with the technology and with the current trends with liberal eugenics and everything is everything is on the transforming aspect. My child is a product of my will. It's not a gift. I've got my hands on the levers. Mm-hmm. I select the child I want and I turn them. I always wanted a child who was going to be a concert pianist, and by hook or by crook, this little darling is going to become a concert pianist. And so the child, it's the transforming part of parenthood has completely overwhelmed the affirming part.
Hmm. And this, I think you can see it, it's an expression of kind of broader trends in society and in child rearing more generally, that I think, you know, the rise of so-called helicopter parenting. And I think there has been a sense in which people have become more tightly, their parents more kind of tightly grip their children and steer them where they want to go in a way that would have been a bit more alien potentially in previous times. So I think, I mean, I'm not harking back to some golden era. I'm sure growing up in, you know, the Victorian times as one of 12 children expected to go down the mine with your dad at the age of 9 was no panacea or anything like that. It was some golden era. But I think certainly beyond, even, you know, before we get into messing around with genetics, there is certainly a cultural trend in society towards being more controlling and seeing children as ultimately an expression of your own self. They're a projection. You project onto them your own desires, maybe what you wished you had done, but also how you believe a good person looks like is, and I'm going to shape and mold this tiny human being to be a kind of reflection of my own inner self.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, to try and trace where's all that come from. It's you're right, it is completely different understanding of parenthood, I think, compared to what it was 100 years ago. I mean, partly it's just family size, isn't it? If you've Absolutely. Got 10 children,
yeah, you know, you can't.
You can't focus on them all. They're, no. The little darlings are going to do what the little darlings are going to do. Whereas if you've only got one, there comes this massive parental attention.
And they're your one shot, right? So yeah. If you have 10 children, you could say, well, I hope one of them becomes a concert pianist, but 9 of them probably won't, and that's okay. But if you only have one, they have to be the concert pianist. They have no choice. And so you're going to go all in on, you know, start piano lessons at age 3 and all that kind of stuff.
I think that's right. And of course, also, it's a kind of very middle class phenomenon, isn't it? So I've got the wealth and the resources and the technology. I'm now going to research concert pianists and early, you know, and the best kind of piano to buy my little darling. Yeah. And,
what was Yo-Yo Ma doing when he was 2 years old? Because I'll do whatever that is.
Exactly. Yeah.
And you see this in the certain cultures. I think there is a strong correlation. So, like, you know, famously, South Korea has, I think, one of not the lowest fertility rate in the world. You know, the average woman has, I think, 0.6 children when replacement rate is 2.1 or something like that. So big problems for South Korea. But part of this is, I understand, analysis is that there is such an excessive emphasis on education and private tutoring and getting into university and rising up the career ranks that parents feel obliged to invest hundreds of thousands of dollars a year on their children and flog them to within an inch of their lives doing homework and extra stuff. And it's just not possible to do that with multiple kids. And so there's some kind of vicious cycle where the fewer children you have, the more people feel the need to kind of invest in them and make them become little mini-me's. And that means that you're going to have even fewer children because it's too expensive and too difficult to do that multiple times. And so these kind of cycles progress and you see fertility rates spiraling down, even as, you know, South Korea has some of the highest rates of kind of teenage depression and suicide in the world as well.
Yeah, and it must have quite a lot to do with global internet culture, isn't it? Because for the first time now, I can be monitoring children around the world and comparing my little darling with how children are doing elsewhere and discussing what the best ways are. So there is something very unhealthy about this. And of course, you can almost guarantee that when the little darling gets to 16 and decides that he's really interested in football and playing the piano is a complete waste of time, you can just see the kind of tensions and...
When parents have to get disillusioned because they discover that actually they haven't created a tiny little clone robot to fulfill all their desires, but this is actually an autonomous, independent human being with his or her own feelings and desires and identity. And that conflict, I imagine, can be quite destructive to the family if your vision of the good is of children being shaped in the likeness of their parents. Whereas I think a Christian vision of the good is we want our children to be shaped after the likeness of Christ, so that everyone in the family is trying to become a projection of someone else rather than the children simply being shaped after the likeness of their parents.
Yeah, and also, interestingly, in the Christian understanding, it seems to me, is an idea of uniqueness, that God saw you and knew you and loved you before the foundation of the world, gave you a name, wrote your name in the Lamb's Book of Life, and called you lovingly into existence as a unique and irreplaceable person. You're not a copycat of anything else, you know. So there in Christian theology is a deep sense of wonder at the uniqueness. And so when your little darling is born into the world, the first thing we just say is, aren't they wonderful? Aren't they unique? Aren't they precious? Yes.
Because they reflect aspects in the image of God that no other human being before or future has.
Yeah,
they are precious because they give us, because they are unique, and because they give us a fresh insight that's never really existed in this exact form before into the Creator.
I think it's a wonderful idea that, you know, each human being is like a portrait done by a master artist, you know. But if you've got 10 artists and they all produced a portrait of the same person, you'd have 10 unique masterpieces. Yeah. And that's the image, that we have billions of unique masterpieces.
Yeah.
And there's something about the reality of God, which each one of us have a unique grasp on. It's a lovely idea, and it's so tragic to see this controlling spirit of the age, which is fascinatingly is part of technology, and in particularly part of information technology. Because as we come to an end, just something to point out is that the invention of the term cybernetics, which was invented in the post-war era to describe information technology, and which is where we get sort of cyber crime and all that kind of stuff, actually comes from the Greek for a steersman, the person in the boat who directs where it's going. And so there is this
Kubernetes mastery, or something like that, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the mastery of there's something about information technology which is all about control and mastery, and it's the mastery of nature. And this is just one example of how we're trying to master our own human nature.
And that's what I liked, what you said about the Christian vision is about holding an attention, affirming and transforming. Because it's not that as Christians we just say children are perfect when they're born and we just sit back and marvel at their uniqueness their whole lives and do nothing. Like, and in fact, it can be quite harmful to children to if they, all they experience is complete affirmation unconditional acceptance. But actually we say, no, children are affirmed as wonderful, unique, precious, different. But we also believe that we want them not to be mastered or controlled, but to develop, to grow, to flourish, you know, a kind of organic metaphor about growing from a seed into a plant, you know, to flourish, to be transformed, to become more like the person that God always had in mind when he created them. And that's so right. We don't just wallow in affirmation, nor do we lean exclusively into kind of mastery and control, but we believe in affirmation and then transformation through, you know, discipline and education and fellowship and apprenticing and all these other kind of methods of Christian discipleship. They apply equally as well in the home and for parents as well.
Yeah, and the literal meaning of the word education means to draw out. It isn't to impress your own will. It is to draw out the potential that is there. And isn't it interesting that all the way back in the biblical tradition, we see the importance of teaching your children. This is a constant theme of passing on to the subsequent generations, you know, that but it is... we teach and we educate and we form, but we allow ultimately people, we set them free to become the people that God intended them to be.
And Paul has that metaphor in the New Testament about kind of growing into fullness, you know, putting aside milk and baby food and growing up. And it's not about completely changing who you are, but it's about, as you say, like drawing out what is already inside and recognizing that actually this is a journey of growth and development. And when we die, we don't want to be exactly the same person we were when we were born, because we want to be closer to God and more shaped after the way of Christ and more closely reflecting his ways and his heart than we were when we arrived in this earth.
So being a parent is a great calling, Tim, but it's not the easiest.
Terrifying, really. Absolutely terrifying.
So yeah. You end up with this concept of the good enough parent. You know, that's a very important concept.
It is a very important concept. I think we mentioned it before in the podcast. Yeah, that no one is perfect. And I think you can get wrapped up in knots. And I think some of this, you know, liberal eugenics stuff comes from this idea that, like, I have to do right by my child. I have this weighty responsibility to make everything perfect for them. And I think that, you know, in other ways flows out through the kind of helicopter hyperprotectiveness. I can't let my child, even when they're 10, you know, walk to the park by themselves, because what happens if they something, you know? And actually accepting a modicum of risk and allowing your child to deal with the ups and downs of the world is also part of parenting. And I think being gracious to yourself and saying, yes, I have a weighty responsibility to shape and transform and affirm and love this child into fullness of life, but ultimately I'm co-parenting with Jesus, and it's not all on my shoulders, and there's grace for mistakes. And, you know, Dad, it will shock you to discover, but you made mistakes with me and I turned out okay. And I'm going to make mistakes with my children and they'll turn out okay. And so on it goes.
It's a jolly good thing, isn't it? God's grace is greater than our failures.
Absolutely. Amen to that. Well, that's a good place to end. Let's wrap it up there. Thanks, everyone, for listening. I'd love to know your thoughts. Would you ever consider screening your children for certain traits? Have you ever spat into a test tube and to find out your DNA and your heritage? And are you worried about who might be holding onto your DNA and what it's going to be used for? Get in touch with us. Love to hear your thoughts, your challenges, your questions, your feedback. You can email molad@premier.org.uk, and you can find lots more information and resources on Dad's website. That's johnwyatt.com. And you can find some of my journalism and other things on my website, tswyatt.com. But we'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.